listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Dane County and the city of Milwaukee are considering whether to require people to wear masks in public to limit the spread of the coronavirus. We'll look at what local and state officials have the authority to do coming up. Now, are you a hardcore fan of a TV show, movie series, game, whatever? Or are you a fan who feels scared off by those really devoted fans? Often when we think of fan communities, either online or in real life, it's the super committed convention-attending fans dressing up as their favorite characters who make the picture. But what about all the other people who like a geeky thing or two or three, but not the whole package? Do we have to have enough geek cred to be considered true fans? And what happens to those fans when they don't match the stereotypical demographic of fandom because of, say, their age or gender or race? Kedra Chaney is a pop culture critic, essayist, and co-founder and publisher of The Learned Fangirl, a website that focuses on pop culture, critical writing, and academic scholarship about fan communities. She's written about pop culture, fan culture, and social technology issues for many publications. Her piece, Confessions of an Adjacent Geek, was published in Uncanny Magazine. Kedra, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Will you start your piece, and I want to start here with the person who introduced you to Star Trek, your mom. Can you talk about your mom and her relationship to Star Trek fandom?
Sure. So I started the piece talking about this past Thanksgiving. I was talking to my mom while we were watching a rerun of Star Trek The Next Generation. And I remember thinking that I like to call myself a second generation Trek fan. And my mom was the person who really introduced me to Star Trek. She always talked about watching it while she was pregnant with me, the original series, and then watching Next Generation with her growing up every Sunday afternoon. But I never really thought of her as a Trekker or a Trekkie, and she never really called herself that. So I just asked her out of the blue, like, do you consider yourself a Star Trek fan? And she basically was like, well, no, not really. But then we spent the next 20 minutes or so talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine and just like the Star Trek lore. So she is to a certain extent, but she doesn't self-identify as one. So it got me thinking about kind of fandom and identity and what it takes for somebody to really embrace a part of fandom as a core part of their identity or even a peripheral part of their identity. And then the essay just kind of went from there.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, even if you're a big fan of something, you watch a lot of Star Trek or Star Wars or what have you, there's always a bigger fan than you out there, and it becomes this question of, well, do I have the credentials how to be a true fan? Why do we think of it that way?
Oh, I think it's interesting because I feel like this has always been an element of fandom. There's always that idea of like what makes you a true fan, what makes you a hardcore fan versus a casual fan. But I think now, especially with social media culture specifically, it creates this flattening of experience where people really come in kind of feeling like they're at the same level. And so you see fans who like spend 24/7 online living and breathing fandom. And so it's easy to feel like you don't compare if you have somebody who's like their entire online persona is dedicated to being part of fandom. But I think that element has always been there. I think there's always a kind of gatekeeping that happens with certain communities of fans that feel like you have to pass certain rules to be invited or to feel like you're really a part of something. I just think it's exacerbated now by the way that social media kind of makes what you consume a part of your identity by the default.
Well, I had pulled this tweet from last month that got a lot of attention from, you know, a Star Wars fan. I'm quoting here, seeing the Star Wars movies does not make you a Star Wars fan. Actual Star Wars fans have done some of the following. And then they give a list, you know, read the novels, read books, read some of the comics, watch the animated shows. It goes on and on. So there you are, social media people trying to give explicit rules that say, yeah, you're a fan, you're not a fan. I don't know. It seems like if you're a hardcore fan, you'd want to welcome, you know, you'd want to be inclusive and bring people in to the stuff you enjoy.
You would think. And I think in many cases, there are people that say the more the merrier. And like, we want to make sure that everybody feels welcome and involved. But I think that, you know, a lot of what it comes down to with any kind of sense of identity is that you want to feel like you're unique. You want to feel like what you do, what you enjoy, makes you stand out in a crowd. And so you want to believe that there's certain rules that only certain kind of people with a level of passion or dedication or, you know, for some people, intellect would be into something that you would be in. And so people do create those barriers, whether it's online or off. I think a lot of it has to do now with like with social media, with Twitter in particular, you can like really display that and use that as an opportunity to like parade your fandom for an audience. I call it performative fandom, and I don't necessarily think of that as a bad thing. I think we all perform our fandom if you're going to a concert or to a movie or to a con. You want to share that with others and you want other people to know, but I think there's a level of performativity that comes with online culture that people really want to show themselves as the best fan. And so, yeah, especially with Star Wars, where there's so much to consume, I could see why people would say you have to consume all of it before you really call yourself a fan.
Talking to Kedra Cheney about fandom. If you're into, you know, Star Wars or Star Trek or a video game or a board game or it could be classic cars. It could be any kind of hobby that you really get into. What makes one person a true fan, another not a true fan? Now, Kedra, there's a stereotype of the fan of this sort of thing, and it's somebody who looks like me a certain number of years ago, a white, youngish guy. What happens when gatekeepers say, yeah, that is us, and people who aren't that try to get in?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that there's always been, or at least traditionally, there's been the stereotype of what a fanboy is, and the fanboy is usually white and male and, you know, a particular kind of geeky person. And that has never really been the case. There's always been diversity in different types of fandom. You can always find different type of people in different communities that have interests. But I think that, you know, in terms of marketing, I think that with marketing in general, there are always certain demographics that are seen as more valuable than others. And with geek franchises and with pop culture in general, that kind of stereotype still applies, where people see a certain type of value demographic and see other demographics as the other. And I think that now more than ever, you're seeing different groups of people really push against that in public spaces. You're seeing a lot of insistence towards diversity, not just in portrayal of media, but also in the representation of fandoms within fan communities. And it doesn't always meet with approval. People aren't necessarily welcomed when that happens, but I think you're seeing more and more different groups of people coming together and either insisting on having that kind of representation in fan communities or creating our own fan communities where the different diverse groups of people can communicate with each other and share experiences with each other in our own way.
I wonder sometimes if the hardcore fans end up actually driving content creators, because you see when a Star Wars movie comes out or a new line of a comic book comes out or whatever, and there's something different in it. Sometimes there's that hardcore fan reaction, and the creators of this have to decide, do I cater to these people who we know are going to buy our stuff, or do we try to keep that that outreach out there to everybody else? Do you think that's a quandary for the people who are actually, you know, making stuff?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think it is. And I think that, I mean, this is something, it's not specific to geek culture or geek fandom, but you see now with a lot of television shows and movies where the showrunners, the writers, the producers are online really paying attention to what fans are saying, really taking that feedback to heart. On one level, I think it's great that creators are listening to fans, but I think it does get to a point where if a creator is feeling pressured, if not bullied, by certain fans for not going in a direction that fans want to go into, it can be complicated and thorny. And it's not necessarily, you know, this is me coming from the perspective of like a Gen Xer, like, so I kind of remember a stage before this. So not necessarily knowing that you were going to get what you want to get as a fan, that there was a kind of a wall and a barrier between fan and creator that meant that you could feel empowered to do your own thing, create your own version of what you would like to see in a piece of media, and feel freedom to do that in your own time, as opposed to pressure the creator themselves to create a storyline that you want to see. I think that's a little bit different, say, than wanting to have a certain representation or diversity within a portrayal versus just wanting to see exactly what you want to see in a storyline, which I think are two entirely different things.
We're talking with Kedra Cheney. She publishes and co-founded the site The Learned Fangirl and has written about pop and fan culture for many publications. We're talking about her essay titled Confessions of an Adjacent Fan for Uncanny Magazine. We want to hear from you. Are you a hardcore fan of a TV show, a movie series, or a game? Or are you a fan who feels maybe a little scared off by those really devoted ones? Would you consider being a fan as part of your own identity? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Kedra Cheney. We're talking about her essay, Confessions of an Adjacent Fan for Uncanny Magazine. We want to hear from you. Are you all in when it comes to a certain game or movie or TV series? Or do you like these things, but you don't feel quite like you're enough of a fan, given what's out there? If you ever felt either fully inside or outside of a community that was focused on an interest of yours, how did it feel? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll go to your calls now. Tony is with us in Milwaukee. Tony, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Tony?
So I consider myself a fan mostly of three different sections. One is Harry Potter. And I find myself kind of giving a side eye to people who say, oh, I like Harry Potter. And then I'm just like, oh, what's your favorite book? I'm like, oh, I just watched the movies. So just kind of commenting on how there is sort of that section. But then I also like Doctor Who. But I don't care how many seasons you've watched, how long. I'm welcoming everyone with that. And then I also have a third section, which I really like, anime.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize... I kind of have a little bit of side eye because I remember kind of growing up and you were the weird kid, you know, when you liked sort of things like that. So I kind of wanted to comment on just, do you think social media has connected all these people, or are they making new fans and making it more available to people?
Tony, thanks for that call. That's interesting, Kedra. Are we making new fans of things like anime with social media, or all those kids who felt like they're the weird kids just finding each other now and being fans together of something like anime?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think that social media has made it possible. So no matter what you're into, you can probably go online and find at least two or three people who like the most obscure thing that you think you had no other person that would be into. I know, like, I'm a big music fan. I'm a fan of a lot of heavy metal groups, and there's groups where I thought I was literally the only fan of a particular group and found, like, five or six people who also like this group. So that does happen. But I also think that it creates new fans. I think that especially with anime, and I think about, like, with K-pop and with a lot of different things where people find out about these different types of pop culture from other people, and it does bring new people into fandoms while connecting other people. And I think that's the positive thing about social media, is that it does allow people to expand their horizons, get into something that they didn't think would be for them, and find an entry point and a connection.
Tony, thanks for that call. Go to Colin now, also in Milwaukee. Colin, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Colin?
I just wanted to say, so I've long been a fan of a lot of things, comic books, Doctor Who, like Tony said she was, a lot of things. But I've always found a lot of openness in my experiences with my friends. And so a couple of years ago, my fiance and I went to a convention, and it really came to a shock to me. We were standing in line, And there were all these fans that were just very rude to my fiance. I think because, I don't know, I just got the sense like they didn't know how to talk to girls, to women, and it really baffled me. She's a much bigger nerd than I am. My favorite superhero is Superman. Hers is Martian Manhunter. So
there you go. Colin, thanks a lot for sharing that. And you hear this kind of story sometimes, Kedra, a woman not feeling welcome in that hardcore geek environment sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, that's a common story. I mean, especially with some of the geekier things like comic book conventions, comic book stores. There are different environments where just traditionally there's a lot of entrenched sexism, and where women in particular don't necessarily feel welcome. And it's like a boys club that kind of keeps women out. And I feel like it's better than it used to be, but it's definitely still there, especially in some more traditional enclaves of geekdom, like comic book stores and whatnot. But I think that now you find a lot more cons that are very inclusive and really want to try to make it a safe and inviting and welcoming place for women, for people of color, for all sorts of folks who didn't necessarily feel welcome in different communities before.
Colin, thanks for talking to Kedra Cheney about fandom, being a fan of something in popular culture, why there are gatekeepers out there, whether people feel like they are really fans if they're not hardcore fans. Kedra, we had a caller, I think his name was Brian, who couldn't stay on the line, who said he had been to a convention and been surprised by the diversity he saw there. And I'll say, some years back, I don't go to a lot of these conventions, but I went to one in central Wisconsin, and it was one of the most diverse environments I had seen here. Pretty even gender mix, a fair amount of racial diversity, people with things identifying them as veterans or active duty military. The reality is, it seems like there's a pretty diverse audience for these things out there.
Yeah, there always has been, and that's the great thing. And I think, as we've been talking about before, with social media, with a lot of different ways for different groups to connect with each other. My experience growing up was this was pre-internet or pre-social media, and so a lot of what I did in my like primarily African American neighborhood was communicate and talk about geek stuff with kids like me. And it took until I went to college for me to meet other geeks from different backgrounds. Now you don't have to leave your home to meet other people who have the same interest as you, who are very different than you. And you can go to places like cons that are more committed now to having diversity and welcoming diversity. So there's a lot more entry points than there used to be even like 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, for different diverse groups of people to get together and geek out.
Let's go back to our callers now. Sarge is with us in Eau Claire. Sarge, hello.
Hello, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Sarge?
Well, I used to own the largest game store in Eau Claire for many years, and I grew up around role-playing games, Doctor Who, comics, pretty much everything that's considered geekdom. Through the years, I see there has been changes in things, especially with social media. Social media does allow a lot more people in, which is really good to the fandom, but at the same time, it's giving a voice to the people that want to be exclusive. So all you hear are the people that want to exclude people. But when people came to my store, everyone was always welcome. And there was never a time when people would say, oh, you don't belong here.
Sarge, thanks a lot for the call. Kedra, there's the voices on social media, as Sarge says, the exclusive voices on social media make a lot of the noise but don't necessarily represent what's really going on out there. Do you think there's something to that?
I think there's something to that. I mean, I definitely think social media lives off of Discord. So the loudest voices do tend to be the ones who want to exclude and want to gatekeep. But I think that, you know, you're going to find inclusion and exclusion everywhere, online, offline. You're going to find pockets that are very welcoming. You're going to find pockets that aren't. And sometimes it's not a harsh exclusion. Sometimes it's, you know, gatekeeping in a friendly way or a faux friendly way, saying like, well, do you really know X, Y, and Z? Doing little things that make you feel excluded and not necessarily saying you don't belong here, but also not making people feel explicitly welcome. So I think it's a little nuanced. I think that you can find people who are loud and who really want to make trouble and to leave people out. But I think you can find even in friendlier environments, places that don't necessarily make fandom feel welcome for people that don't fit a certain type. So I think he's right, but I think that there's a lot of nuances to what it means to be included and excluded in certain communities.
Sarge, thanks for the call. Kedra, you introduced this idea of the adjacent geek in the piece that started this conversation. Are you embracing that role? You know, even if you haven't seen every single episode of whatever the show is, you will embrace that geek adjacent role?
I do. I used to feel a little bad about it and guilty that I kind of have fallen off of my geekdom. But at this point, I really am embracing being geek adjacent and knowing that I can't keep up with everything. But like that my passion is still there. It just may be a little slower than it used to be or slower than other people. They're not as passionate, but it still exists. And I still find, you know, a lot of joy and community in the things that I like. I just, you know, I have room for other things now. So, and I think geek adjacency is something that people should feel comfortable and happy about. It doesn't mean you're less of a fan. It just means you're a different type of fan. And there's room for us all.
Fantastic. Kedra, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Kedra Chaney is a pop culture critic, essayist, and co-founder and publisher of The Learned Fangirl. We talked to her about her piece, Confessions of an Adjacent Geek in Uncanny Magazine. Well, does this sound like your life a little bit? Do you find yourself as a fan of something? Are you like Kedra? You found yourself stepping back a bit from something you used to be really into? Why is that? Maybe you found something that you're really into now. Tell us all about it. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up, we'll take a look at the debate over whether state and local governments should require people to wear masks and to limit the spread of COVID-19 and whether, depending on state and local laws, they have the power to do that. And we'll ask what you would like to see done to slow the spread of the coronavirus. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent hosts her weekly call-in for kids and parents. This week's special guests are Andrew and Polly, creators of the Ear Snacks podcast. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, with the number of positive COVID-19 cases surging in parts of Wisconsin and around the country, officials are trying to take steps to slow the spread. As of this morning, Dane County no longer allows indoor service at bars. Outside, still okay, and restaurants can only open their indoor capacity now to 25%. In addition, Dane County Executive Joe Parisi told WKOW-TV that you might have to wear a mask over your face when you go out in public. Here are a couple of his clips.
I think it's a very real possibility. Right now, everything's on the table. If we're not able to get this under control and under control quickly, guidelines will continue to tighten.
Also today, a Milwaukee Common Council member introduced a plan to require mask wearing in public. The Common Council is expected to vote on that this coming Tuesday. On the state level, Texas announced a face mask requirement this afternoon for counties with at least 20 coronavirus cases. Kansas will become the 19th state tomorrow to impose a mandate. Our neighbors Michigan and Illinois already do. But Governor Evers' administration says don't expect Wisconsin to follow suit because of the state Supreme Court ruling against the stay-at-home order. Robert Kahn is a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis and an expert in mask law. Rob, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there are strong feelings, clearly, on both sides of this mask debate. Why, for us Americans, I guess in particular, why has this become such a touchy subject?
I think in some ways it's just a perfect storm. I think there is a red versus blue divide that maps onto everything. I think some of the initial rollout on both sides on the part of the president who didn't want to wear a mask and part of public health officials who pushed masking in a very broad way led to an ideal situation where people treated mask wearers or mask abstainers as symbols rather than people.
You were quoted in a newspaper article recently saying that this goes back more than a century, at least to that that so-called misnamed Spanish flu outbreak of just over 100 years ago. Are we having the same kind of arguments as we had then?
Yeah, I mean, there are a great deal of similarities to it. Masks are a wonderful tool. They help you open up businesses and do things. At the same time, there's just a tendency for police, unelected public health officials, and the like to over-enforce mask bans so that what happens, and, you know, anecdotally, I live in Minnesota where they're considering having a statewide mask ban. People don't wear the mask when nobody's looking, when they're not worried about getting stopped by a police officer, where they're not in a store that demands it. And it leads to a kind of credibility issue because you wind up giving the state discretionary power to enforce mask wearing, but you're also told, well, gee, and it's gotten much better. So, but like 3 or 4 weeks ago, the message was whenever you go outside, wear a mask. Now there's uncertainty in the California mask mandate and the Pennsylvania one and Kansas that, well, gee, if you're outside and you can socially distance, maybe you don't mask. If you have speaking to someone who needs to lip read, maybe you don't need a mask. They're getting better. I think there's learning, but I think that there's still a sense of lack of trust on both sides of the mask debate.
And when it comes to enforcement, I know there have been some concerns about, you know, if we have this mask mandate, but it's kind of selectively enforced. I know people in New York and I think Philadelphia raised concerns that mask mandates were more aggressively enforced for African-Americans in particular. Do you see that as a concern now around the country?
I think that's a huge issue. It's a huge issue because as one of the studies that advocated mask wearing pointed out, mask wearing is an issue for African Americans to begin with because of the tendency to associate mask wearing with criminality and risk. So I think that's a real problem. There's actually a town in Oregon, I'm forgetting the name, or a county that apparently exempted people of color from their mask ordinances because of a concern that wearing the mask will cause a problem. So it's a very difficult position that over-enforcement of mask laws can put people of color in.
We're talking about mask ordinances with Robert Kahn, professor of law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. You can join in with your thoughts. Should masks be required by towns, by state governments, at whatever level? Join in at 800-642-1234. Robert, when it comes to state and local and county governments, for that matter, ability to actually impose a law like this, I don't know, is it a patchwork around the country, what actual authority we have?
It actually seems like in many states there is authority. The Wisconsin legislature v. Palm decision from about 6 weeks ago is an outlier. To some extent, it's a perfect storm. It reflects Governor Scott Walker's Rule 21 that restricted the scope of the administrative state. Most other states don't have an issue with this, so Wisconsin is really in a different situation because the stay-at-home order itself was thrown out, so there are some questions about whether a municipality could enact a mask law, although from what I've read, I'm not an expert on administrative law. That's a separate question and it seems to be worth figuring out.
Now we see Texas today, the Texas governor who had steered clear of mask requirements, saying, yes, we're going to require masks in counties with, I think it was 20 or more positive coronavirus tests. Does it surprise you to see even a state that might have been as resistant as Texas now saying, yes, we are going to require masks in certain circumstances?
It does, though. What's interesting is, well, one thing is just the spike in Texas, and I think that goes to, you know, we don't know what's really driving the spike. It is going to lead to changed opinions about stuff. The 20 cases thing is interesting because one of the places where there's a lot of pushback is I'm in a rural area. COVID hasn't come here yet. I don't see the need to mask. And it has a little bit of a safety valve there. You know, hopefully a bunch of Texas, a bunch of counties remain spared and there aren't 20 cases, but presumably that would eventually cover the entire state.
We're talking about whether governments can and should compel people to wear masks during this pandemic. Law professor Robert Kahn is with us from the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been wearing a mask? In what circumstances? If so, would you like to see a mandate from your local government, county government, state government, at the federal level, maybe just in certain situations or certain guidelines, as we just heard about in Texas? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about government mandates to wear masks in public. Dane County thinking about it. The city of Milwaukee expected to vote on a measure next week. The Evers administration says its hands are tied after the state Supreme Court struck down safer at home orders back in May. Several states, do require masks. Texas joining the list, at least in certain circumstances. Robert Kahn is with us, law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. He's been quoted a lot lately on mask law around the country, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think people should wear masks in public during this pandemic? And should there be laws at whatever level you'd like to see to require mask use? When and where, or should it be completely voluntary? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Tony is with us in Madison. Tony, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Tony?
I'm not sure about, I guess we should find some way to enforce the policy, but I was saying that I think a lot of the problem initially came from the fact that a lot of, you know, the messages we were getting were mixed in the beginning, and a lot of people seemed to be trying to play psychologist instead of healthcare professional. We were getting a lot of messages about, you know, we don't need to wear masks. And there was kind of a message about how this might have been because there was so few masks available and they were trying to, like, not, you know, make people panic and go mass buy masks or whatever. But I think there was a lot of a mistake made there where they tried to play psychologist a little bit instead of doing their job and just giving people facts and saying, you know, this is dangerous, could be dangerous, wear a mask, instead of we don't know, you know. It just seems like there was a little bit of a role playing there by them as a psychologist that really didn't need to be there. I don't know.
Thanks a lot for the call, Tony. And yeah, that change of message, Robert, can you talk about the importance of, I guess, having a clear and consistent message, or when the message changes, as it did with masks, of really explaining why the message changed?
Yeah, I think Tony's right on the money. I think, you know, masks help prevent the spread of the virus. There was a change in March. There was a sense that masks weren't necessary, helpful, might be encourage you to be too reckless with social distancing. It changed in April because of the spread of the virus and the idea that doing something's better than nothing. And it's good for public health authorities to admit when they've made a mistake or a situation has changed, science is changing. They're continuing to study the effectiveness of masks. The other thing that to me has been helpful, but I wish they had done so earlier, is distinguishing more of when you need to wear masks. indoors versus outdoors, in crowded situations versus non-crowded situations, and also understanding that what you're looking for in a society is 80%, 90% compliance with masking, so that if there is a situation where you can't mask, you have a nasal condition or asthma, it's still consistent with, you know, other people masking in other situations.
We heard from a lot of people on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dee Dee, for example, says, I wear masks, but only at certain stores. You don't need one if people would maintain 6 feet of distance. The problem is they won't distance unless you make them. You know, without clear guidelines, sometimes it feels like everybody, Rob, is winging it when they go out in public. Is that part of the problem with the lack of consistency we were talking about, that we're all kind of guessing our own personal policies?
I think that's true, and there's certainly an element of that. I also think that it's understanding not just distance but time. You know, we're considering reopening or closing our law school, and one of the things that the health people have told us is if you're exposed for 15 minutes with someone 6 feet or less away from you, you have to start thinking about contact tracing if the person's positive. I think that if you're in a setting where you're going to be someplace for a while, if you're shopping in a store and the store doesn't have good ventilation, masking seems important even if you're more than 6 feet apart. I also think there's something to be said for carrying a mask around. I cycle a lot in Minneapolis. I have the mask around my neck. When I see people, I put the mask on. When I don't see people, I take the mask off. I think there's some common sense, and it's common sense that you want public health authorities and experts to reflect, and I think they're doing a better job of it now. I think that at the height when COVID was really hitting hard in New York and Connecticut, it was hard not to want to do everything. And while people sometimes talk about taking a mask off, mask refusal as a symbol, mask wearing can be a symbol too. You know, a mask doesn't do anything if you're by yourself and there's no one you were going to infect in the first place. If you're indoors in your house, you don't have to wear a mask. I'm not wearing one now. So, you know, I think that it's really important to be level-headed in this so that you can convince people that you might not want to wear the mask, but here are certain situations where it's really going to be helpful and you should do it.
And Rob, I've seen concerns from businesses in Wisconsin and around the country saying they'd like some kind of clear guidance from a local community because they're trying, you know, the restaurant, the store, whatever, might be trying to have and enforce their own mask requirement. But without that wider policy, it's, you know, they're fighting the battle with those individuals who don't want to wear the masks. Does that ban, or not ban, the mandate to help solve businesses or help solve those problems for businesses?
I think so. I think that it is a huge part of why there's been a move towards mask mandates, in addition to the increase in caseloads. It's a huge problem. You're going to have conflict between mask wearers and non-mask wearers. In fact, you know, some of the there was Johnny Cash's granddaughter who got shamed for wearing a mask when she was in a Walgreens. If she's just doing it because she has to follow the law, then you don't have to say that you're a bit of a wimp because you're wearing a mask. I have to do it. It's what the law says. So, yeah, I think it helps businesses. It helps mask wearers. And in that regard, it's a good thing.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Robert Kahn is a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. We talked to him about local, state, and maybe federal someday mask requirements. We heard from a lot of you on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tristan writes, I traveled this weekend and didn't wear a mask. I watched others who did. Funny how often they take it off, put it on, take it off, put it on, etc. Tristan says, provides a false sense of security. Catherine says people don't realize that the longer they complain about not wearing a mask, the longer the economy and life as we wish it will suffer. So share your thoughts again over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Earlier this week, we heard about the 150,000 Wisconsinites waiting for their unemployment claims to process. Historically, jobless benefits are not received equally by workers of color. Bram Sable-Smith reports on one African-American mother in Milwaukee navigating that system.
Alfreda Casterlo could hardly bear the first few weeks of work from home. The disrupted routines upset her 20-year-old daughter, who has autism.
I didn't know what to do. I was praying. I had to lay with her and rub her forehead and keep her engaged.
All of that while continuing to operate switchboards for Northwestern Mutual in Milwaukee. Then she lost that job. She immediately filed for unemployment help, not realizing how many other laid-off Wisconsinites had done the same.
Maybe I just didn't pay attention because I was working, but I had no idea that 200,000 people at that time were waiting on unemployment.
That was April 24th, and Casterlo is still waiting for her claim to be adjudicated, meaning she's gone 2 months without income while also supporting her daughter and granddaughter. She's about $2,000 behind in rent and started getting food stamps in May. And she says she's lucky because she can borrow $20 here and there as she waits for her jobless benefits to clear.
So that's where I'm at, and just trying to get my unemployment seems impossible.
Historically, laid-off Black and Latino workers receive unemployment aid at lower rates. An Urban Institute analysis about the Great Recession found that just 24% of laid-off Black workers received unemployment benefits in 2010, compared to 33% of white workers and 29% of Latino workers. Margaret Sims co-authored the paper. She says there are a number of possible reasons for the disparity for African Americans.
But perhaps one of the more important ones is that they lived in less generous states.
Meaning states with stricter eligibility requirements. In Wisconsin, lawmakers passed a dozen laws since 2011, restricting access to unemployment assistance. It's hard to say if those laws affected laid-off Black workers differently. The Department of Workforce Development did not have reports available on race, gender, age, or income. And Rebecca Dixon of the National Employment Law Project says that's part of the problem.
You manage what you measure, and if you're not even measuring it.
Dixon says in past recessions, Black unemployment peaked well after white unemployment. So while measures like the expanded jobless benefits passed by Congress this March have been helpful to many, letting them expire in July, as they're set to do now, would be inadequate.
And the other thing is, we don't know what the impact of state and local government layoffs is going to have on this, because that's also a place where lots of Black workers have middle-class employment.
Nationally, Black workers typically face double the rates of unemployment compared to white workers. That gap has temporarily narrowed during the pandemic, although the difference is still significant. Valerie Wilson of the Economic Policy Institute says a big reason why
is the disproportionate representation of Black workers in essential occupations.
Of course, that comes with increased risk of exposure to COVID. And Wilson says she'll be watching to see if the persistent 2-to-1 unemployment disparity returns in the coming months. Back in Wisconsin, DWD Secretary Caleb Frostman says the research is clear. The coronavirus pandemic is disproportionately affecting communities of color, both health-wise and economically.
You know, this is a once-in-a-generation opportunity for us to redefine the relationship between work and quality of life, what that means for different communities, including Wisconsin's communities of color.
That does require getting benefits to the thousands of Wisconsinites waiting. There may be good news on that front for Alfreda Casterlo. She wrote an impassioned email to the governor's office last week telling him how bleak her situation was. A couple days later, she got a call from an adjudicator.
This man was so friendly, I wanted to hug him. He was like, I'm going to take care of this for you. You're assigned to me now. I'll handle it. And he made me feel like he was so capable.
Casterlo says she just wishes other people waiting months for unemployment could experience that too. Bram Sable-Smith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That story comes from a partnership between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Watch. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, remember that updated trade agreement with Mexico and Canada? It actually went into effect this week. We'll find out what changes and what it means for Wisconsin. Between watches, warnings, and advisories, weather alerts can be confusing, and the National Weather Service is looking for your input. A weather expert tells us how you can help make forecasts and alerts more useful. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and Meathead is back on the show. As always, he'll have some great grilling advice. We'll specialize in ribs a little bit and throw in some side dishes along the way. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, a lot of the public health measures in place today came from the outbreaks of the past. Kate and her guests look at lessons Wisconsin learned from the AIDS crisis of the 1980s. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we talk with a Milwaukee journalist about why he and other black residents in the city are frustrated with the lack of progress being made on addressing racial inequality in the city, and hear about a new project to envision a better future for Milwaukee communities. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.